We're convening the Wednesday, April 27, 2005 committee meeting for the Subcommittee on Human Services of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. And we're dealing with a public hearing on House Bill 5038, relates to the budget for Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families. And we welcome back Ramona Foley and Jim Neely. We have received about 20 pages of data that is in response to the requests that were made last Thursday. We appreciate this information. We received it last night. I got about 6 o'clock, which didn't allow much time for us to review it. The rest of the committee did not even get it till this morning. So we're less prepared than we would like to have been to review this beforehand, but we can nevertheless go through the presentation that that we still need to have on various programs, and it gives us some additional data that we can use in our in asking questions. So if y'all would come forward, we can begin. First, Sheila Baker, if you could give us an overview.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee. The information packet that you have in front of you, as Representative Richardson noted, the first 20 pages are primarily numbers showing the budget by more specific program detail. The 2003-05 budget column reflects as of the November 2004 rebalance. So that's updated from actually what the governor's budget was using when they made their decisions, but it's the most official legislatively approved, or the most recent legislatively approved budget. So that's that column.
And it has been amortized. I mean, it's taken those figures as if it were those figures for the full 2 years, right?
Right, Mr. Chair. The rebalance that the agency does looks at expenditures to date and then projects them out for the rest of the biennium. So that is the full biennium budget number for those individual programs. And then the other column shows what's in the governor's recommended budget. So again, once we go through the rebalance and then the reshoot, those numbers will change some, but it does show you where the governor's budget is right now. And the information that the agency's put together shows both the funding by fund type for the programs, as well as identifying an average monthly population and then an average monthly cost per case. So you can see the changes there. As you go through, some things are perhaps raise questions for you in terms of a big general fund shift or a big federal funds increase or reduction. And we can talk about those. But this is the information that the agency is prepared to respond to the questions about more detail by program. Then the second set of information there is just a copy of what was in the governor's recommended budget in terms of revenues for each of their program budget structures. So the self-sufficiency program revenues, the child safety program revenues, substitute care, and et cetera, et cetera. So you can see which revenues are used to fund which particular pieces of the budget, and there's some historical information there as well. So it shows the original legislatively adopted, the assumptions for revenues in there, the 2003-2005 estimated, which at the time this was prepared would have been the April 2004 rebalance or budget authority, then what was in the agency request budget, and then ultimately what ended up in the governor's recommended budget.
On page 3, starting on page 3 of that packet, columns 5 and 6 both say agency request, and yet if you go down and there's different numbers there, would you explain what the difference is between those two columns?
Mr. Chair, I can't.
Okay. Could we get the clarification on that? I'm looking at
where are you talking at,
CAF dash C19.
C19
for the child safety revenues.
Good morning. Here are my
My name is Nick Todd. I'm Assistant Director for Finance and Policy. I'm sorry, I didn't hear where.
Look at it's in the second staple packet, CAF-C19. Okay, and then from there on for two or three pages, you have columns 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Both say agency request under 2005-07, but as you look down, the numbers are not the same, and so I don't understand what those columns are referring to.
Well, they add up to the governor's budget. Oh, no, they don't.
Well, it looks to me, Mr. Chair, as though the column's in there twice.
Well, look halfway down the page. On one column, it says a negative $317,173, and on the next column, it says a positive $1.5 million.
That adds up to the governor's recommended, though. No, it doesn't. Mr. Chair,
I'll have to look. We're just seeing this LFO document this morning right now, so I'll have to go back and look and see what that column should actually be labeled.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we can go back and determine which one actually added up to what the agency request was. I would say for purposes of this exercise, it's informative, but it's not critical because. How do I say this? It doesn't matter what the agency requested because the governor's budget, the governor's recommended budget is the budget before you that you will be dealing with. The agency request is informative in the sense that it provides some information about what the agency would have funded if, you know, the world was a perfect place and revenues were unlimited. But the it's for comparison purposes only, I guess, or for information purposes only, and the decisions that you make will be based on the governor's recommended budget, not what was in their agency request.
That's true, but we'd like to know what...
We'll get that for you.
Right.
Thank you. And then packet three?
And then the third packet, there are 8 graphs there for the major programs in children, adults, and families. The first one is the number of temporary assistance families. Then you have domestic violence, emergency assistance, employment-related daycare, food stamp households, adoption assistance, regular foster care, subsidized guardianship, and residential treatment. So the intent here was to respond to the request for more information about program trends and where the programs had been and where they were headed.
Okay. These graphs, all of this information is very valuable, and I know that a lot of time has gone into this. I just want you to know that we really do appreciate it and the effort that is behind it. It's so easy for committee members to make requests in 30 seconds that can cause hours and hours of work, but this is a very useful and will help drive our discussion today in several areas. There's a couple of ways that we could proceed. One would be just to kind of have questions answered as we go. But I think what I would like to do, because it may drive some of the conversation, is to have questions that have come up since last Thursday by members of the committee be asked first and then see if they lead into other discussion. And then after that's done, then we can go back into looking at specific programs that that you need to have us look at, okay? With that, I would like to start with the graph that deals with permanent adoption, the adoption assistance, and then also I'm asking if this is related to permanent adoption payments, meaning post-adoption, or not. And then also I need to know in the packet number 1, the actual data, the program budgets, I didn't see an area where permanent adoption payments show up, and so I didn't know if that it was supposed to be there or not there, or if I have it wrong.
Chair Richardson, I would yield to Sheila to see if there is there new information in here about the amount of the subsidized adoption.
On page 10 of the numbers packet, the second to last set of numbers there, adoption assistance, okay, relates to the chart in the other packet. So if you're looking on page 10,
adoption assistance,
you'll see for current budget authority for this biennium, a total funds of $86.8 million, and then in the governor's recommended budget, it's total funds of $112 million. So you can see there is a significant increase there. I think that's about a 15% total funds increase, and that is directly correlated to the projected growth in the caseload that you can see on the chart there.
I'm sorry, I lost you there, and I was I got the graph.
You got the graph.
Okay. Where other page are you on?
In this packet, page 10.
When it says adoption assistance, is that all adoptions pre and post, or is this relating specifically to post-adoption payments?
Chair Richardson, these are finalized adoptions where the adoption subsidy or the assistance payment is now following the child. But all of these would be after the finalization of the adoption.
Okay, this is something that I'd like to have you address, if you would. I've previously discussed with you the graph that takes place in the last 8 years, where my recollection is that we've gone from $20 million to now a projection of $112 million for payments after children are adopted. And that trend is, you know, I mean, that extra $20 or $30 million here, an extra $20 or $30 million there, it's coming from other programs. And so why is it necessary? You expect this 20 to 30% growth every biennium to continue, and if you could just give us your opinion on that.
Okay, Chair Richardson, Kathy Ledesma has joined us, and she is our program manager in the area of adoptions. I think she can address that.
Thank you, Chair Richardson, members of the committee. For the record, I am Kathy Ledesma, program manager for adoption. That includes adoption assistance at the Oregon Department of Human Services. As we reported in our early communications with you this session, the major budget driver for adoption assistance is purely the number of children who receive this benefit. And it is considered under federal law as a welfare benefit, actually. And it is to support, is to remove any financial barriers to the adoption of special needs children.
Okay. If it's a welfare benefit, then are the parents means-based or means-tested?
There is no means test, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Why? Let me ask you this. Of the new adoptions, what percentage of adopted children receive ongoing payments after their adoption is complete?
Mr. Chair, the approximate percentage is about 95% qualify for adoption assistance. The qualification is based on the child, not on the adoptive family. Of those 95%, approximately 95% of the children actually do receive the subsidy post-adoptively.
Okay, now this is not all children that are adopted. These are children 6 and up. Or would you talk about the qualification?
Chair Richardson, members of the committee, the qualifications for special needs are spelled out both in Oregon statute and in federal statute, and those are reflected in federal rules and state rules. In Oregon, to qualify for adoption assistance, a child purely an age test. The child has to be special needs. That means having one or more physical, mental, or emotional handicapping conditions, be a member of a minority group, be a child age 6 or older, or be a member of a sibling group. If it's a sibling group of just 2 children, one of the children has to be age 6 or older. And if it's a sibling group of 3 children or more, and we have many sibling groups of 3 or more that are placed together adoptively, they can be children of any age.
Okay. What percentage of children that are adopted does this relate to? It's 95% of special needs, or is it 95% of all children adopted?
Mr. Chair, when we talk about adoption assistance, it is overwhelmingly, primarily children from state foster care. So those children exiting foster care to a finalized adoption. In very rare circumstances, and the federal government made that more difficult in 2001, will a private adoption qualify for any amount of adoption assistance?
Is it possible to means-base this based on parents' incomes if we chose to?
Mr. Chair, of the children who receive adoption assistance, about 80%, approximately 80%, receive 4E federal adoption assistance. That's 4E. The match rate is about 61% federal dollars and then 39% state general fund dollars. Our interpretation with the Attorney General of the federal rules about 4E adoption assistance is that it cannot be means tested. The federal rules state that it can't be based, we can't means test 4E adoption assistance. The other approximately 20% of children are state fund, state general fund only children. And that really is up to this body whether or not you would want to impose a means test. In determining eligibility for adoption assistance, we use the phrase that we are 4E blind. We don't look at a child's 4E or non-4E eligibility in determining the amount of assistance for which the child is eligible or whether or not they're eligible at all.
Senator Bates.
A couple questions here. We're looking at a cost that's rising and rising and rising in this particular program. Let me ask you the flip side of this question. We are seeing an increasing number of children, I believe, from conversations I've had, that are meth affected and drug affected, and so this population by itself seems to be growing. If we didn't have this adopted program in place, I would assume these children would probably be in a foster setting. Have you calculated what that would cost us if they were left in foster care and not placed in adoptive care? Is one more expensive than the other? I mean, from the children's point of view, I would expect that being placed in an adoptive home is probably a better option than being in the foster system. What's the comparative cost of those two issues? I mean, is the foster program being held down by using adoptive because they're sliding through the adoptive, so the foster program isn't growing exponentially like this one is? Do we have an opportunity here to see this maybe flatten out later when we get, because we're in a growth time here where we're moving children much faster out of the foster program into the adoptive program. So are we seeing a temporary boom? I guess it's going to flatten out later. What's your expectations for the program?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, you ask a whole lot of questions there, and I'll try to give you a full picture of that. First of all, we have provided to you, as buried in a lot of documents that we gave you, the difference of the cost in maintaining, on average, a child in foster care versus the cost of maintaining a child with adoption assistance. The difference is it's about $587 per month is the difference. So, and that's based on the average amount of adoption subsidy or assistance is $400. I think it's actually $404. And the median amount of foster maintaining a child in foster care is $987 per month. That does not include the administrative costs. That's just the payment that goes to the provider, whether it's the adoptive provider or the foster care provider. So that's one set of answers. The other thing that you referred to, the large number of meth-affected children that we're seeing, and it is absolutely huge. Will we begin to see that level out? Well, that's anybody's guess. Hopefully, yes. Ray of light here is that the Boys and Girls Aid Society, and I think that you've heard from them previously, they are our longest and strongest partner in adoption, applied for a grant from the Meyer Foundation, just received word late last week that they did receive that grant. It's about $100,000 a year, and it's to place meth babies. and it is to keep those children out of the state system. We're thrilled about that. They now are hoping to leverage that into a number of other grants so that if the only problem that there is with that child, when I say only child, is that the child is meth affected and the parent wants to plan adoption, hooray. That's great. And Boys and Girls Aid has been to numerous trainings at the federal level and is prepared to do that. So we do see, I expect that to level out somewhat, that not so many meth babies will be coming directly to us from the hospital. Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, that's page 26 of the DHS priority list from April 19th is where that came to you.
Mr. Chair, one of my frustrations with these things is these people may know their budget so well it seems transparent that it's not to me that I have to ask those questions. And this is not a criticism of you. It just, you know, help us here. If you've got a program that you can show that it is actually cost-effective in comparison to the alternative, it would save us a lot of time and trouble to know that before we go down through this. Because I share the chair's concern. This is a lot of money we're pouring into this program. But if it's a cost-effective way of doing it, it's the best thing for children, then I'm there.
Well, the assumption, though, that I think that was inherent in your question, and it may not be the case, and that is that if you don't pay somebody to adopt, they're not going to adopt. And I got a number of emails from people after I brought this up before, and I have adopted a special needs daughter, as you know, and the people that are emailing me were saying, you know, why would you have to pay somebody to adopt? Does that make sense that a person adopts because they're going to get paid for it? I mean, the idea of adoption is to assimilate a child into your family, not as a source of income. Is that, I mean, you know, so these questions come up. And when you're talking about 95% of children that are being adopted that qualify, and you said even if there's behavior, well, I don't know how that really applies, but every child that's about to be adopted has behavioral issues. I mean, you know, I don't mean behavioral, emotional issues, because they wouldn't be where they're at if everything was fine. And so, you know, so I don't know how those definitions all play out, but the idea of just randomly or automatically, I think for 95%, I think it's getting pretty close to that, saying that if you adopt this child, you're going to get $400 and some a month payments for the rest of the child's minority, is a huge cost to society that may not need to be done. I mean, if I'd been offered that, I'd have taken it. You know, why not? But that wasn't the determining factor in whether or not we adopt the child. And so I'm just trying to get a sense for this.
Mr. Chair, I understand your frustration and your questions about that, and it is something that we deal with on a daily basis. We're required by the federal government to let the prospective adoptive parents know of the availability of adoption assistance. That is our obligation. We let them know about that. Many adoptive parents, and I can't give you an exact number, will say, no, thank you. I really don't need a subsidy, nor do I want a subsidy. However, because of the way in which the federal rules are written, what we do ask them to do at that point in time, if they choose to do so, is to sign an agreement only with us, because if at the point of that the adoption finalizes, they have not entered into an agreement with the state, the child is forever disqualified from receiving any amount of assistance at all. So family circumstances change, children's conditions worsen, sometimes there are later diagnoses that we weren't aware of when the child was placed adoptively, and so it's really an insurance policy. Also, of those families who receive adoption assistance, many receive Medicaid only, and that if they have a primary insurance, if they already have health insurance, that's just a backup insurance policy. It's not the primary insurance for the family.
Yeah. And by the way, I adopted so long ago, I don't remember what the terms were. I don't know if I was offered it or not or anything else about that. So, I mean, that's not fair for me to say anything about what we did or didn't do. But as far as the focus on budgets are concerned, this trend line, you know, is... It's going with that. And if you look at the next graph, it shows trend lines for foster home care as well. And so that'll feed, as that line goes up and there's more and more kids in foster home, then that also feeds, of course, to the adoption rate. And so we're just trying to come to a sense of whether this is something that is needs to be evaluated or it's just the way it is. And the fact that there's a high federal match is an issue, but it's still tax money. You know, and so I think it's not dispositive, I think.
Mr. Chair, I really understand your concern about this. This sticks out, you know, $112 million budget line. It certainly sticks out. Back in August, Sheila asked us a question. Sheila Baker asked us a question. She said, I noticed that your number of finalized adoptions for 2003 was down. And why was it down? Well, it was down because the Adoption and Safe Families Act passed in 1997 that put new requirements on the state to move children forward to some kind of permanency and not let them just, you know, the federal word was languish in foster care. So, and then we began our efforts actually in 1995, even before that was passed. So you can see the trend line from 1995 really takes off very, very quickly, because what we did was go and assess whether or not we could achieve permanency for many of these very troubled children who had been in foster care for a very long time. We do look for the number of children who move from foster care to adoption in the next 10 years to level out somewhat, and that is, of course, predicated on the number of children coming in the front door who will be unable to return home. It certainly is preferable that children have permanent homes rather than to stay in foster care, but I do understand your concern about the cost.
And Chair Richardson, I wanted to add also, I don't think at the time that the federal law passed, I don't remember at the national level conversations that really anticipated what the growth might look like. And just so you know, instead we're not ignoring this issue, Kathy and I have both been participating in national conversations with other states, because it was predicted, and we are fast approaching the place where the adoption assistance caseload is larger than the foster care caseload in this country. And Congress recognized they might get there, and while that's a good thing for children, it also has brought an unanticipated burden to states in terms of the state dollars that also support this program. So just so you know that Oregon's not the only state that is actually having this conversation and trying to look at, then what are the things that would have to be different? What are the federal regs that would have to be changed if the nation were to say, wait a minute, there should be some middle ground here in terms of how we get children into adoptive placements, because I've not heard anyone say that's not a good thing. It's just that as a cost driver, it reminds me a bit of what's happened with Social Security and the anticipation that now we're going to have a lot of people on Social Security. We can't just shoot them. We've got to figure out some way to pay for it. So with adoption, it's still a very good thing that these children are getting into adoption, but we'd be very open to continuing those conversations and sharing some of what we're hearing from the national level about how they're dealing with this issue.
Is there other responsibilities that DHS retains other than sending checks after an adoption is completed?
Mr. Chair, yes. As you can see, the next budget line underneath, I think it was on page, Sheila, help me.
Page 10.
Okay, page 10 of your document. The next line is post-adoption support. And you can see all of that money comes out of federal fund. That's 4B funding. It's a grant. And that is to provide post-adoption services, support services for families to avoid disruption of those of adoptions that we create. So that is a very cost-effective services. They don't actually provide the counseling, but information and referral services, connections to parent support groups, education, lots of workshops out in the community, and opportunities for adoptive families to gather.
So it's opportunities for the families to have the benefit, but it's not active case management where you're out following up 5 years later to see the house clean.
Mr. Chair, that is correct. We do not do case management.
Okay. Senator Bain?
Yeah, I share some of your concerns about the program from the point of view of cost, but I also want to make it very clear where I stand in this program. Of all the things that we do in DHS, this may well be the most important. And let me tell you why I think that way. I've talked before about the cycle of poverty, the cycle of crime, the cycle of child abuse, the cycle of drug and alcohol abuse, and I see it over and over and over in one group of our population in our state and in certain families. This program is the one thing that strikes directly at that. It's moving kids who are at risk, who will grow up to do the same thing as their parents for the most part, out of that and into adoptive homes. I don't think the foster care system can do the job that adoptive homes can do. And so I think this is the most important thing in many ways that is going on in our state. It's a dramatic change. We will not see, I believe, the benefits of it for about 15 years. And what I expect to see and hope to see those benefits is a lower number of people in our criminal justice system, a lower number of people seeking drug and alcohol treatment, a decrease in child abuse, and a more productive citizens. For the higher education level, and all the ills that we deal with in our society, this is going directly at. But we're not going to see it right away. And this is a huge investment we're making into the future to try to deal with that. And it's a certain degree we have to take this on faith that this will work. I think the federal government's looked at it that way, and we're looking at it that way. It gives us a little bit of heartburn when we see these numbers going up so fast. But I think in the long run, it's the right thing to do. Looking at it carefully as we go along to make sure those dollars are being spent well, I agree. But the overall process, if it's going to do what we hope it's going to do, is the right direction to be going. Finally, I wish we'd done this 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Chair Richardson and Senator Bates, if I could respond to that. I think that that is exactly what the purpose of subsidized adoption is, and I think what's driving the conversation now is states do not have the same resources they had when the law was passed. And what we began seeing and what we're very cautious about is if we erode the front end of the system so that families are not able to access certain services to start with, and if all of the funding suddenly is going to the deep end of the system, then it creates something in our communities that we haven't really signed up for yet. We still believe that families have to have opportunities. They need to have things like the relief nurseries and so forth. So I think it's really the dilemma of where the dollars are going that's really driving this conversation, because at the national level, I know that that's been kind of the mantra, is if children can't be returned safely home, they should not stay in foster care. They need to be in permanent placements called adoptions. But I do think it's kind of that shift of, and many families come to us and they say, if we had had that money, we could have supported our children ourselves. We would have actually had a chance at it. And so it's kind of like always trying to find that balance in making sure that we are allowing families at the front end what any family or any one of us would expect to have in the community to be able to be successful as a parent.
Follow-up question, Mr. Chair? Well, you just made a comment that I don't necessarily, I'm not going to necessarily agree with.
Okay.
I think what I heard you say was many of the families where their children were adopted out, they said to you that if they had that money initially, they could have taken care of this themselves.
Oh, if they had four kids, they could get $1,600 a month.
Did I just hear that from you?
Chair Richardson and Senator Bates, we have had families present to us. And I mean, that's also a national issue, that families and advocates who support birth families say what's happening is so much of the information, and that comes up around res treatment, a number of high-ticket items in the child welfare system. If that money is invested with families in order for families to be successful, if there's some way that all of a sudden magically, now that doesn't take care of the methamphetamine problem. There are families that are going to always need the child welfare system. But in general, if all of the funding that we think of that helps families initially were to move suddenly to the back end of the system, that causes concern for those who advocate for families and being able to successfully raise their children.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bates.
To lay it out there, I'm going to respectfully disagree. Okay?
Okay.
Families I've seen, it's not a matter of money. Money is not the problem. The problems of those families are much deeper than financial. And the continued abuse I see generation after generation after generation has nothing to do with money, or very little to do with money. It's a lot deeper problem than that.
With that in mind, would you give us just a rough idea, if you have 10,000 adoptions expected in the next biennium, what percentage of those are because of death or non-drug related or crime related? I mean, just what is the percentage of population? What's the background?
Mr. Chair, just a slight correction. We don't expect to do 10,000 adoptions in the next biennium. Yeah,
that's the total number of people that were receiving this.
Yes, we expect to do about 1,800 adoptions in the next biennium that will, some children will age out, others will be added. And,
thank you for correcting that. I was looking at the wrong column there.
Yeah, thank you. Very few children from out of foster care are adopted because a parent is deceased. Very, very few. We were just working on a bill about this yesterday. The over, we know that over 80% come from homes in which they had prenatal or postnatal exposure to drugs. And we document that at the time that we established the adoption assistance. We just did a recent look at that. So over 80%. The remainder of the children would be from families that we were unsuccessful in reunifying for one reason or another. It could be chronic neglect. It could be severe sexual abuse where the parent goes to prison, or something like that.
Okay.
So very few adoptions result from the death of a parent.
Okay. Representative Hannah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions, and we've been through quite a bit of data and information back and forth here. I didn't quite understand the group of children 0 to 6 years old, if they were a single child. What happened to that population?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hannah, the categories that qualify a child as special needs are not mutually exclusive. So a child may be under the age of 6 and not qualify on the basis of age, but has a physical, mental, or emotional handicapping condition, which, to give you some further definition, requires a physician's diagnosis.
Okay.
So that, and those are documented in the adoption assistance files. So it isn't just a caseworker saying, oh, this child needs some counseling.
Okay.
We do have to have an official diagnosis.
So now I'm again looking at page 10 at the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
The average monthly cost per case from 404 or close to 405 to 444, a 10% increase. Is that the average you paid to the family, the adoptive family?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hannah, yes, $404 is right now the average amount that goes to an adoptive family for a child.
So that amount, on average, rose 10%. I mean, that's what we're talking about there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hannah, that's projected to rise by about $40. We have, I think earlier we gave to you some cost containment measures that we have taken and will continue to take to keep the lid on the cost per ADP. But one of the reasons that will continue to rise for probably another 8 to 10 years is that as older children age out of the system and are replaced by younger children or other children who have more severe problems, then the cost, the ceiling for adoption assistance, the maximum amount that a family could receive for a child, is the amount that the child would have received had the child remained in foster care. And as you can see, the difference, $987 to $400, we operate way under that ceiling. But as that ceiling grows, as children are more troubled and require more special assistance in foster care, that is the maximum amount. Whereas 10 years ago, the ceilings were lower than that. So older children with lower subsidies age out. Other children are approved for subsidy, qualify for subsidy, and come in at a higher ceiling.
Would you talk more about that as far as how much is actually paid? Is it based on criteria, or are all new children getting the same amount as they would have gotten while they're in foster care? What is the cost?
Sure, Mr. Chair. As you know, the foster care amount, we have a base amount, and then there's the special rates, and that's here in the budget. Each of the special rates is individually determined. The federal rules require, and I believe also our state statute requires, that each child's amount of adoption assistance for which they qualify must be individually determined. The federal law prohibits us from saying everybody gets $400. If you qualify, $400. Each one has to be individually determined, and that's based on the child's special documented needs, such as from that a physician would give a diagnosis, and a psychologist or another counselor would say, would give us some idea of what the family may need, minus all of the other resources that are available to the family in the community. So, for example, adoption assistance is not used to pay for private school because the school has the responsibility to provide an IEP and special education consistent with the child's needs. So we take into consideration, even if the family says, oh, I don't want to use that service, we still say that's a service that's available to you, and we will not fund that.
I don't want to beat it to death, but I'm asking for a figure. What is basically the range of children now that are being adopted of payments? Is it 400 or is it 800? Or what is generally being paid on new adoptions?
Mr. Chair, I can't give you that exact figure. I know I have it back at the office, and we could also provide you with a chart of the range of all the amounts. The number of children, total children, that would include all of the new ones, who receive in excess of $800, I want to tell you, is under 10% of all the children. We have more children right there in that $400 range, a very few at about $135. Are very old subsidies. Those are children that are aging out. But right between, say, $350 and $500 is really the mode, the most children receiving that amount.
Okay. Do you have any questions? I would like to ask the number of adoptions that are handled by private adoption agencies in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, these are going to be ballpark figures for you. In the last state fiscal year, out of about 2,800 total adoptions, adoption petitions, children for whom adoption petitions were filed in Oregon, the state did. Children coming out of foster care accounted for over a third of those. The next largest category out of that 2,800 were step-parent adoptions. And then the remainder were either attorney-only adoptions or adoptions handled by private adoption agencies. And between the two of those categories, the adoption agencies were the larger number.
Okay, so DHS handles about one-third of the adoptions.
DHS handles about a third of the adoptions. In addition to that, and I'm not sure if your question was getting to this or not, in the purchased adoption line in our budget, those are adoptions in which the private sector participates on a contractual basis with us. Those are both in-state and out-of-state agencies, and we purchase services from them. That's why they're called purchased adoptions, to place children out of DHS foster care.
Okay, you said 2,800 in the last year, and a few minutes ago you said you expect, I thought over the next biennium, 1,800. And so if it's 2 times 28 for the last biennium and we're only 18, is that...
No, Mr. Chair, when I talked about adoptions, and that does come out right, because it's about 900 children per year that DHS is placing out of foster care. So about a third of 2,800 is 900 and some.
Okay.
Mr. Chair. Yes. Just to clarify, so the 2,800 number is all adoptions in Oregon, and the 900 would be just what DHS is placing out of foster care.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Baker, that is correct. And those are ballpark figures. I'd be glad to send you over a nice little graph that shows you that.
Okay. All right. Are there any other questions on this? And I don't want to go any. I mean, there's a lot more that could be asked, but you've answered the questions. I appreciate that very much. As I look at the materials that you presented, I don't see an allocation of administrative expenses per program. I've asked Ms. Baker about that. She said that that's difficult to provide because you have workers who do multiple programs, and it's difficult to divide that out. Although, from a financial or fiscal standpoint, it's very difficult to determine costs of programs when we have amount of payments being made, and then cost of administration is $180 million for multiple programs. And so is there
a way that you could provide us information that would allow us to know what the real cost is for administering the various programs.
Mr. Chair, again, I'm Vic Todd, Assistant Director of Finance and Policy. The difficulty we have with that in both the child welfare and self-sufficiency is the staff, as you mentioned, are working multiple programs. And so we don't earn staff based on individual programs. And so to tease that out, as you start to look at the self-sufficiency, what you'll see in there is the program support pieces that will, you know, be all of the staff that's associated with CAF, but they also do the medical eligibility. And so the cost of doing that medical eligibility is in the CAF budget. The program expenditures are actually in the health services budget. And so you get, there really isn't an easy way or even a difficult way to tease that out and really separate those into individual components.
Well, apparently someone's already done it if you are allocating part of the cost to the medical portion and part of it to CAF portion. So it sounds like there's already been an allocation that's taking place.
We can, from the time reporting system, give you a distribution in terms of how they spend their time.
Well, then does that give you the ability and have you in your records already allocated percentage of time on a per-employee basis where you say, you know, this is a caseworker and we're going to figure caseworker spends X percent doing this and X percent doing that? I mean, is that already in your computer system?
That's in the cost allocation methodology in terms of when a worker enters a particular code. They're allocated, their time is allocated to the various federal programs.
Do you have the ability to pull from your computer that allocation in such a way that it could give us a reasonable idea of what is allocated for each of the programs as far as your administrative costs?
We can attempt to do that, certainly, Mr. Chair. I'm concerned about it, you know, being used as an accurate reflection, and I just want to, I'm just very cautious about trying to pull these components apart and isolate, a cost that is not necessarily within the same budget area.
Yeah.
And so that's my concern with it. So we have
the only reason I ask for it is that there's no way to determine the cost benefit of various programs without knowing what the cost is. And so if we're helping this many children and the cost is this much, and this program, you know, some huge amount, and if another program that there's, and there's a lot of overlap with mm-hmm. kinds of programs and so forth, and we're helping a larger group of, much larger population, which with a much more efficient expenditure for overhead, then that gives an indication of where the priorities ought to be. And we've tried to prioritize, and the prioritization process has been based on what we kind of think is the most valuable programs, but it's now we're in phase two where we're supposed to be finding out financially if that's the case. And so what I'm really trying to do is determine, is there a way that we could get financial data that would enable us to go through it, talk back to the co-chairs and say, you ought to be aware that these programs, you know, it seems reasonable. This one seems to be a really high overhead compared to what you're getting for it. And without numbers, other than $185 mm-hmm. million dollars for all the programs in that cluster, it makes it very difficult. Now, I'm not trying to put all of your people into, you know, overtime for a week. I'm just wondering if you have the capability to ask from your computer a breakdown that using the allocations that you use for federal reporting or whatever and give us more detail than what we have on the costs on a per-program basis.
Mr. Chair, that's actually how we began. After you made the request, we went back and initially tried to begin to break it out by program, and we really couldn't get there in terms of the time frame that we had.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we ended up with the array that you have today. We can go back and attempt to do something, but it will take us some time to get there. I mean, that's
I'm not asking, you know, I don't want to cause a lot of grief to your department. I'm asking if you can do that in a reasonable time without a lot of allocation of work, other than you get somebody who understands how the computers function,
mm-hmm.
and say, okay, can you pull this out for us, and they can do a run, that would be something I'd like to see.
Okay.
If you've got to pull out paper and pencil and calculators, then I don't want you to do that.
We can go back and look at the random moment system and see what we can pull out of that. It won't be that we could distribute the budgets, but we could give you an idea of how that actually gets distributed.
All right.
And that maybe that would help.
Thank you.
Okay.
Can I shift over to page 4 of 20? It says Sexual Assault Victims Fund. And we have a shift in allocation of funds from other funds to general fund. And so I'm wondering if you could explain why it was $591,000 in other funds last biennium and it's going to be $532,000 in general funds this time.
Mr. Chair, that is essentially a definition change in terms of how they are treating those criminal fines and assessments. Historically, they were treated, you're referring to the one I think you're referring
right.
to.
Sexual Assault Victims Fund. Uh-huh.
Right.
So it's criminal.
But historically, that's been treated as other funds, and they have determined that those should be treated as general fund. So it's just a shifting in terms of the categorization.
Mr. Chair. Okay. First, Sheila Baker has something, and then Representative Hammond.
I'll add a few seconds of discussion here. In the governor's budget, what he is proposing is that a number of programs that were previously funded by criminal fines and assessment account monies dedicated statutorily to them not get that dedication anymore, but that the criminal fines and assessment account revenues go instead into the general fund, and those programs then get a general fund allocation. So it's a fund shift, but it's also a 10% reduction in the overall funding for those particular programs. So you'll see a couple of them in this budget. There's more in the public safety subcommittee that they, in the budgets that they are dealing with. But this is sort of a blanket approach that the governor was taking to the criminal fines and assessment accounts money.
Okay, does that also apply on page 6 of 20 where it says domestic violence services?
Mr. Chair, yes. Not all of the other funds in that domestic violence services category is from criminal fines and assessments, but some of it is. And so there's the similar switch from some other funds to general fund, but with a 10% reduction in the overall amount. The domestic violence services also get some other funds from, I believe it's marriage license fees and some other revenues that are dedicated to it. So it's harder to track exactly what's happening there, but again, it's treated, the criminal fines and assessment account monies are treated the same in that program as they are in the Sexual Assault Victims Fund.
Okay. On page 7 of 20, under family shelter, the description says family foster care homes that are prepared to receive a child in their home at any time, day or night. Are the payments made to these family foster homes regardless of whether there are children present or only if they are actually caring for children?
Chair Richardson, it's based on whether or not they're caring for children, but they are accessible 24 hours for emergency placements.
Mr. Chair. Senator Bates, can we drop back to
page 6, special rates foster care, reduction of general fund money, other funds and federal match. Are these the homes we're talking about where these medically fragile foster care children are?
Chair Richardson and Senator Bates, that is the category. Yes.
Follow-up question?
Certainly.
What's the policy decision here? And these are children who, many of whom will not survive, severely have severe emotional and physical handicaps. What's the policy decision to reduce to reduce spending on these children?
Chair Richardson and Senator Bates, we are looking with our managers. If that particular reduction remains, we're going to try to do some management actions to look at that whole category. But the medically fragile and the foster parent that you heard from yesterday, that category of children are the most severe children that we have in the category. About 50% of our foster care placements right now are garnering the special rate, and so we probably will need to look at those that are less medically intense than what you heard about yesterday and what was in the newspaper on Sunday.
Go ahead, sir. And we'll hear back from you when?
Chair Richardson and Senator Bates, I would think within the next few weeks. We've had a special task force looking at special rates, and an internal task force to look at what are our options in terms of making some adjustments. But again, I was also very moved by the article Sunday, and certainly the individual, the lady who came and spoke yesterday. And the prognosis for many of those children, the prognosis might initially seem grim, and yet we have seen some of the children with the kind of care they're receiving actually survive into adulthood. And so it's, as a public policy, we want to make those children, put them in the least restrictive setting at all possible, but still have the medical needs met. I have the same worry that you all heard about yesterday, and that is it's quite an undertaking for an individual to be willing to provide that level of care, even if she does have some assistance. I'm afraid there are not a lot of foster families potentially out there that take on medically fragile children. In some states, those children have to have nursing home care. And whether or not they survive, they may be in the nursing home indefinitely. But we do have a unique approach with those medical foster homes that we hope to be able to keep.
This is an important issue.
It is an important issue, and I think you need to look at this very carefully. These are the ones that are least likely to take care of themselves, and these are the ones we appear right now to be turning our back on. That's just not appropriate.
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, we'd be glad to get back to you all as well to let you know what those options might look like as we move towards summer.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll put a major mark on that because that may be a reduction that's not appropriate, so we'd like to know what we're dealing with. Other questions from the committee? On page 8 of 20, foster care prevention provides services or items which will result in immediate prevention of foster care placement and will return a child home to a safe environment, provide up to 2 months of payments within 12-month period, and are at regular foster care rates. Would you explain what...
Chair Richardson, that refers to our... we have something called a 4E waiver, and it's an effort on the part of Congress to say if you're going to have to place a child in foster care, but in fact you could keep the child in the home by using that same amount of money. For example, if you have a family who presents today and they've got three children and they are homeless or they're being evicted, by paying the rent 1 month or paying the utilities 1 month, if that means those children otherwise would not have to come into foster care, it allows the flexibility to do that. And so it's a way of trying to offset the growth in foster care by saying you have some flexibility to use a limited amount of those same dollars to keep children within their families initially.
Okay, the line beneath it, entry says 4E waiver foster care. Are those different from what you just described?
The way the program works is, Chair Richardson, the 4E waiver and the foster care prevention work together for the same purpose. You can use those dollars. You see there's some general fund dollars in the foster care prevention piece, and then the 4E waiver dollars are also including general fund, but they both are heavily funded through federal funds as well.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ramona, correct me if I'm wrong, but the 4E waiver foster care has to be tracked separately because there's a requirement from the feds in terms of cost neutrality that we have to provide them information on. And so even though the purposes are similar, the two programs are tracked separately for that reason.
Chair Richardson, that would be correct. You have to demonstrate cost neutrality on the 4E.
You know, I'm still going back to 20 minutes ago when the point was brought up that some parents are saying that they would
not have lost their kids if they could have been the foster parents. If you have four kids and you're getting $425 a piece, that's $1,700 of income to raise the kids. I mean, this...
Chair Richardson, I would refer you to a national spokesperson on that particular issue named Richard Wexler, who is extraordinarily critical of foster care in this country, saying that that's his position, that's what's happening, is we are putting money in the wrong place. And he says that frequently and has a lot of national audience for that particular purpose.
This is everything that we're dealing with is complicated.
But, Senator Mr. Chair, at least with the families that I work with, but I can't say that they, well, quite a few, once they got in the foster care home, they got out of my jurisdiction. I was more of the, in working with the at-risk. And if more money went into the family, they are drug...
That's right. It's not going to be spent on the kids.
They're drug addicted.
Yeah.
And
that's true.
Where do you get mine to go?
It's more complicated than...
I understand. It's not just money.
Yeah.
No, I understand.
Mr. Chair, when you have an opportunity, when we're out of session, there is a family in your district. I believe they live in your district or Representative Gilman's district. And they run a foster home. And they've actually built a house for foster children mm-hmm. with this kind of money and taking kids who nobody else will touch. Mm-hmm. And I shouldn't say that.
But this would be very charitable.
And what they're doing is amazing. And these are just good folks trying to make this thing work. And they take in drug-addicted kids, and they try to keep families together, and they bring these kids in. They've adopted a few of those kids.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the kind of people I think of when I think of who are really going to change our society for us.
Yeah,
and they've had their struggles with these kids. These kids are not, Rebecca, I'm Sunnybrook Farm here. These kids are damaged. These kids are in trouble. And they take on some real challenges and do a great job with them. That money is well spent in that family.
Yeah, that's a huge mission.
It is.
I mean, their life is dedicated
right.
to that.
Yeah. Very good.
Amazing.
You probably have a good point for many cases, but I'm going to disagree with you on this. I have a hard time accepting.
Well, Chair Richardson, as Senator Bates, I certainly didn't mean to upset you.
No, you're not.
I just think that as you think of these issues, there are just so many complexities in terms of what people bring to us. And you can take almost any issue in the child welfare system, especially, and argue it in about three different ways. And I think that's one of the pieces about the system that it's really, we have no followers, almost no followers, because regardless of what we do, we're doing too much of one thing or not enough of the other. And it just reverses depending on what conversation you're in. So.
Yeah.
Speaking of that, would you go to subsidized guardianships?
I will bring Ms. Ledesma up to talk about subsidized guardianships.
But Mr. Chair, I do want to say that there are a lot of families that where there it's not foster care home. We do return children to families that really do try. So I think we have to realize that there's still a lot of families that are just need assistance, and I think the system is helping them with their children. So.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be pretty bad when they're actually removed out of the family.
Well, Chair Richardson and Senator Montesanderson, to that point, it's interesting because I think people have a perception that all children who are removed end up maybe staying in foster care and getting into adoption. The majority of children who come into foster care do go back home, and they go back home fairly quickly because if the family can get assistance or whatever it is they need, whether it's relatives helping take care of the children, that usually happens quickly because it's such a trauma for the children to have been removed. It's those children that you don't get back home that Congress said you really have to have a better plan than just leaving them in foster care indefinitely. Research also shows that when children age out of foster care, 60% of the children who actually age out of the system itself end up going back to their families. So in spite of all of our efforts to say, you know, we need to have a better life or a better situation for the child, statistically children tend to gravitate back to the family that they knew originally, which I think is that's the Chapin Hall research that's been done over long-term foster care.
This kind of cuts back to some comments that you've made, Senator Bates, in that there is that biological connection that cuts in favor of, like, the relief nursery model where they're very intent
on working with the family members, helping parents deal with their problems, not just dealing with, you know, getting the kids out of the situation. I mean, it's ultimately going to be a holistic approach that helps heal a family that will make a lasting difference, if that's possible. Yep. But some are so far gone that it's, you can't wait 10 years for them to finally come out of it and dry out.
And one of the greatest dilemmas is, where's that balance at, and how do you predict which family you can get help to, it will make a difference, and which family you have to say, it's not going to work.
Maybe and drug courts help in that regard because of the carrot stick approach. That's
Chair Richardson, after we talk about guardianship, that might be a segue, though I'm hesitant to bring it up, to talk about the legal representation package again, because I know there were some questions yesterday in terms of how quickly we make decisions on those kinds of cases.
Okay. Subsidized guardianship, and also I would like to have you address interstate compact.
Okay. I can do that. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the subsidized guardianship program began in 1999 as part of our federal Title IV-E waiver. It was intended and is still intended to give an additional permanency option for children who will not be returning home, but for whom termination of parental rights is either not possible or not recommended. An example might be a severely mentally ill mother who is not an immediate danger to her child, however, is not able to care for her child on a day-to-day basis. We don't want to sever her parental relationship with the child. She can still be in the child's life. But if a relative or a foster care provider who's cared for the child continuously for more than a year is willing to be that guardian, we subsidize that guardianship under the waiver.
So they act like a foster parent, but they're just called something different?
Mr. Chair, the big difference is the savings and administrative costs here, because we do not case manage those cases. Once the guardianship is established, there's a six-month review, a court or a citizen review board review, but we're not out there on a 30-day basis managing that family. So that is a big difference. It also gives an additional permanency option to Native American children and Native American tribes who do not believe in termination of parental rights, many of them. And it gives the child an opportunity to have a permanently committed family without severing the legal relationship with the parents.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Interstate compacts.
Chair Richardson, interstate compact on the placement of children is a law in all 50 states and in Washington, D.C. and in Puerto Rico. And I think of it as a large insurance policy, because what it does is it ensures that the child who has to move from one state to another state for purposes of permanency, for example, the child could be going into foster care in the other state, a relative placement if the child's in state custody, or for purposes of adoption, it guarantees that the two states will work together, that the child has the same safeguards around safety that if the child went from Multnomah County to Lane County, for example. And these costs are associated with the child, the transporting of the child to the other state. So, for example, if your child or your eight children had come into foster care in this state and you had relatives in another state, if the state had to intervene and take your children into care, and if you were not going to be able to have those children returned to you, those children could actually be placed with a relative in another state. And the idea behind that is the two court systems work together, the two state social services agencies work together, and the compact guarantees that that work happens and gives this child the same protections as if the child were having an interstate placement.
Yeah, I was contacted by a concerned citizen who is of the opinion that there are adoptions that are being brokered with couples outside of Oregon, and that we are sending Oregon children to non-relative adoptive parents.
Chair Richardson, we have, and Ms. Ledesma can send you the figures, because we looked at that recently to see exactly how many children are being adopted outside the state of Oregon by non-relatives. One of the things that we want to do this next biennium is actually be able to expedite the general applicant pool. That's families here in Oregon that want to adopt children here in Oregon. And sometimes if those families are waiting for an adoption worker in child welfare to get around to doing that study, I hear stories that the worker may say it'll be 6 months till we can get that study completed. Meanwhile, because of the technology advances, we have children who are awaiting adoption who are on the websites, as other states have. And so families will connect through licensed adoption agencies, see children on the Oregon website, and those families may be given consideration for adoption. You're not allowed under the federal law to deny a child adoptive placement based on geographic boundaries. So you can't keep the child in foster care saying this child cannot be placed out of state. But the thing I think we've got to do a better job of is we've got to make sure that we're expediting our own Oregon citizens who want to adopt children. And I think that has been that's been a weakness in our system. And as I look at those cases, many of those cases where the child is placed out of state, they do consider in-state families, but for some reason there may not be an in-state family who can deal with that particular child with his particular behaviors. But it is something we're very sensitive to. And I think we will always have placements out of state, but I think that in fairness to our own citizens, we need to make sure that we're also expediting those families through our system. That's something we've actually talked to the private adoption agencies about. Could some of that work be done with the private adoption agencies, and they could actually help us expedite those families to have them become approved adoptive applicants for Oregon children?
Okay, would you provide me with that information?
We'd be glad to,
and
yes.
I'd like to know what circumstances are.
Okay.
Thank you. You want to, other questions before we segue into the package requesting DOJ attorneys to, and the paralegal approach? As we go into it, would you describe or inform us as to the utilization of district attorneys in this process of helping to assure that DHS has representation?
And Mr. Chair, I will pass out, there was a request yesterday for more detail on the package, so I will pass out a copy of the package that the agency had in their budget, providing you with a little more budget detail, and then the agency's also provided a letter from Daniel Murphy, a circuit judge here in the state, and I will pass that out as well.
Okay.
Yes, Chair Richardson, the package, the two packages, our package and the one from DOJ, are based on, we contemplated that the DAs and the work that they do, usually on the very front end of these cases, that the DAs would continue that particular piece of work. The DAs are a great help to our agency in terms of being there at the point in which the cases generally go for a shelter hearing, sometimes for the jurisdictional hearing. Beyond that, what we're trying to touch with this package is the thousands of children that are in the foster care system that are there beyond the 60-day point when you've had those front-end hearings, and then you're trying to make decisions over the next year primarily as to what's going to happen to this child. Is the child going to be returned home, or is this child possibly going to be a candidate for adoption, in which case you start doing something that the federal law refers to as a concurrent plan. It's that population of cases that we are really trying to look closely at to say, if we had an attorney available or if we had paralegals who are able to help us with these cases, remember that by law these cases have to go to court every year, and in some cases these cases are going to court more frequently than once a year, because the decision making during that first year is so critical. That really is going to be the decisions that have to do with whether or not this family will have their child returned home, or if this family will never have their child returned home. And so we worked with a subcommittee from the Oregon District Attorneys Association, and I think you have copies of the letter of April the 18th from Stephen Atchison, who is who worked with us, and he is the DA out of Columbia County. And they did support the package. Ultimately, they felt that if you had everything you should have in life, you would have attorneys across the board in all of these cases. They realized that that is not possible. They understood the dilemma that we had with not wanting to take this package and have that substitute for the work that the DAs are currently providing to us, because in that case, it would be probably a wash. It wouldn't really help us very much. So we actually drew a diagram of, at the front end of the cases, the DAs, and in some counties, the DAs are much more active than they are in other counties. We realize that. But if the DA is helping with that case to get the legal grounds established initially when children are removed, then how can we fill in some of that void that goes all the way to the point at which, if you decide you are going to be filing a termination of parental rights, right now the Department of Justice steps forward and they have attorneys who handle the termination of parental rights, but it's that large piece in between and the thousands of children in the foster care system that we are concerned about and tried to focus on with this package.
What percentage of the cases would you say are in that concern that you have?
Probably in the neighborhood of 80% of the cases. About 7,000 children at some point during that year will be sitting in the foster care system, and they're not the new entries, and they're not the children exiting to adoption, and so those are the cases we really want to focus on.
Okay, so of those 80%, actually it would be ideal to have attorneys in the paralegals working with them.
Chair Richardson, absolutely. It would be ideal, and we actually were able, in response to some of the questions that were raised yesterday, we had well, we can give you this in writing. We had several examples shared with us from around the state on situations where caseworkers, having gone to court, doing the best they could do, actually were not able to move the case forward. In some circumstances, there are situations in which children may not be in a safe situation, and yet without legal representation, our workers have a difficult time articulating to the judge and to the other attorneys exactly what the problem is.
Okay. Members of the committee, here's the rough. 80% of cases needed. I've got a total of 21,000 cases that are heard. Is that... that's reasonable, do you think?
Chair Richardson, at one point we had looked, and DOJ thought there would be about 15,000 hearings a year that might be in this category.
Okay. I'll check the assumptions that we've got on that. But anyway, this money, and the total of it is $8,576,000 when you take both of the budgets that and put this together, will raise the actual attendance and participation from 5% to 15%. And so we really need 80%, and so we have a problem with nose under the tent issue, because we're talking about $8.5 million to kick it up 10%. And since the need is so great, then 2 years from now, it's not going to be 15%, it's going to be more. And so if we take, and the number that I was able to come up with was for the 15%, it would be about 3,100 cases. And do the math, it comes out at $2,700 a hearing. And then if that were a reasonable number, and then you do the math and take it up to 50% of the cases, just 50, not 80%, now we're up to $28.5 million. But we're only helping half of the kids instead of the 80% that we really need. And so while there's this need here, the issue is going to be, where does this end? Because two years from now, are we going to come back and say, you know what, it's fine, we're going to stay at $85 or $8.5 million, or is 15% going to show itself to be way inadequate because we need 80%? And then where is that money going to come from? And shouldn't there be an alternative looked at rather than merely saying, boy, we got a problem, we're going to solve it by throwing $8.5 million at it, knowing full well that that's just the beginning?
But Chair. Mr. Chair?
Sure. Senator Munson.
I think we have to look at, though, I mean, we're talking about the lives of children, and do you want, I mean, the only, if we don't have the court system do it, do you want then case managers making those decisions, et cetera? I mean, it has to be in the court system.
Something's got to be done.
Exactly.
I'm just saying, I don't know if this is the way to do it. For instance, if the DAs are functioning presently, what about giving some amount of additional money to the district attorney's offices because they're already in place, instead of hiring additional
DOJ attorneys to do this, and then we've got some that are going to now be in Medford, and they're going to be doing Lake County and Klamath County and all of those things. In other words, we're establishing a new bureaucracy or sub-bureaucracy in DOJ when if DAs are already doing this in some cases. Would that be a model? And I don't know, but I'm just not going to say, well, because this is the presentation, we've got to go with this when we can see that it's only going to get more expensive as time goes on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Oregon's an outlier state here. We're the only state that doesn't have this, is my understanding. I may be wrong about that, but I was told that we are the only state that doesn't do this. If the chair's numbers are correct, you could be chewing up a lot of your budget with this when we get up to where we need to be. So how are other states handling the cost of doing this? What are other states doing? I mean, do they accept that as a cost of doing business, and they put that much money in the legal system to... I mean, that money comes out of taking care of these kids.
Chair Richardson and Senator Bates, in other states, they do have representation. In most states, it is through the Attorney General's office, and it might look in different shapes around the country in terms of what the role is of the DA, for example, whether or not there's contract work that's done. That varies based on state laws. I think that it is part of the cost of doing business. I think it is really essential that we realize that running a foster care system without this is extraordinarily dangerous. We have been very fortunate because, I wouldn't say we've been very fortunate, we have had some outcomes that were not good outcomes, and those have been some cases in which caseworkers, in fact, were making recommendations to the court. I think in terms of the DAs, my understanding of the conversation with them, one of the reasons they saw that it was okay to support this package, because we did have the same conversations, Chair Richardson, in terms of in some parts of the state they are more active, they want to do more of this kind of work. But basically, in sitting in a meeting with the Attorney General, Hardy Myers, and with some of the DAs, the thought was this takes us only to such a small threshold that if we're able to go to 15% of the cases and we're able to set the criteria so that, for example, we're not sending a child back home until a lawyer has helped us look at that case, even if the child's been in care a year and a half, when the DA has long not been involved in that case, they're helping us make that recommendation to the court. We feel like it would add a safety element for all of our cases going through court, and the DAs were interested then in having another conversation that wouldn't necessarily be a DHS conversation, but a conversation with the DOJ about what are we going to do about the other 85%. There will be 85, if this takes us to 15%, and you assume that 85% of the cases then still will not actually have legal representation in court, what would it be for a public policy in the state of Oregon to look like in the upcoming years, not for this year? I think they did just agree that right now it is such a pitiful situation in terms of us not having legal representation that something, even a small package, is going to be better than nothing at all. And I don't want to speak for them. I mean, I think they'd be glad to come in and talk about this particular issue. I know that Steve Atchison would be glad to do that, to speak with you all, but that's kind of what I took from the conversation.
We already know what his position is. It's
Do other states contract this out, or do they have any, like injury defense funds? Do they contract it out?
Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, I can only speak to one state in particular, and that was the state that I came from. And we had the AG's representation, and then in certain parts of the state, they did do small contracts with attorneys in some of the parts of the state. We originally had work done by the solicitor and by the DA, and over the years, the model that the state chose to go to was to have 100% representation, but that happened so many years ago. I do remember the contracting process. I understand that that's different here, and it would require some exploration of the laws here to see how that, if that could be accomplished, whether or not it could be.
I do have a copy of a journal from the American Bar Association of 2004, and the title of the article is Standards of Practice for Lawyers Representing Child Welfare Agencies, and it talks about the different roles, and basically it says that there's two areas. One is the agency has their own attorneys, and the other is that you have prosecutorial support for the agencies. And I mean,
we're doing that presently because we already have the prosecutorial support, but the move to have DOJ attorneys assume 10% more at $8.5 million, and of course you said, and then maybe we can look at the DAs doing something in the future. Now we've got both. If that were the case, we ought to be looking at doing the DAs now. I mean, they're presently there. We're solving a problem that is a concern, but it's not a crisis. We've been functioning all these years, and now we're needing $8.5 million to start raising it when the caseworkers will still be in the hearings. The caseworkers will still be doing the preparation. We're going to lose, except we'll lose a whole series. What is the number of caseworker positions that we will lose to transition into paralegal positions?
Chair Richardson, 31 positions.
And so, I mean, that if you're a caseworker and you're about to find out that you're going to lose 31 more of your caseworkers that are doing that because of the other, I mean, I don't know. See, we can't micromanage this thing, but as of yesterday, we were told that 5 hours a week is actually spent face-to-face contact by a caseworker with people, and that the other remainder of the week is doing paperwork and phone calls and correspondence.
Chair Richland, that's one of the inspirations behind the package, though, is to actually free the caseworker up. We will be able to give you, in writing, the specific task that our workers are currently doing that we think would be shifted to paralegals. And respectfully, while it may not feel like a crisis from your seat, it feels like a crisis from my seat in terms of each day these kinds of choices and these kinds of decisions that we have, where caseworkers who, they're not even trained in the law. I mean, they couldn't take the bar exam, and the law is complex in this area, and yet they're going into court and they're saying, Your Honor, I recommend this, or I think the child can go home now, and I think we're in a very precarious situation. I understand the dilemma around the budget and around the dollars and the tough choices here, but I do think from our perspective and the seat that we're in, we see it as a pretty risky situation that we're in right now.
Understood. Of course, your paralegals can't take the bar exam, and a bar exam affects 100 different areas of the law, and we're focusing on one specific area. But be that as it may, I understand that you wouldn't be bringing this forward if it wasn't a huge concern. It's about prioritizing and spending money, and which programs does this come from to do this. And is there another way to do it that would be more economical, that would just magnify what is currently being done? You know, I mean, by, you know, whether it be hiring a private attorneys or expanding funding for the DAs. I don't know. I just am not one to quickly jump onto this kind of a recommendation when I see that it's really just the beginning, and that it's going to be a huge increase over the finance in the future of funds, draining funds that will not be going to services.
Chair Richardson, I think, back to Senator Bates' question, one of the ways that other states look at it is it's part of that whole process of moving children out of the system. I mean, we've got more children coming into care in this state than we've ever had before. We've got more children staying in foster care than we've ever had before. We could add 200 more workers, and I will come right back in here and tell you what we will have is more children coming into foster care, more children staying in foster care. The more workers we add, I'm really worried that this is about actually changing a part, a really critical part of our business. And if we are not able to change that part of the business, I don't know what the repercussions would be ultimately. But I do know, hearing the conversation, I listened to the tape yesterday, from yesterday morning's testimony, I do think it is a way, regardless of who is doing the legal function, if the legal function is done well, it enables us to move children, first of all, make sure those decisions are correct to start with when children have to come into care, and to be able to move children either back out of the system quickly or to expedite them going to another permanent plan. That was actually cited in our federal review in 2001. They said the uniqueness in Oregon of not having legal representation, the federal office believed, actually does delay permanency for children in terms of getting them out of the system or getting into something else.
That was mentioned yesterday, that sometimes by the time you do get the legal input, you find out that there are requirements that haven't been met, which then have to be met. And so I'm not saying that nothing needs to be done. I'm just concerned about the proposal and what it will mean for future funding.
I appreciate that.
Other thoughts or questions on this?
Mr. Chair, I would ask that we're going to have to make a decision on this in the next few weeks, I believe, hopefully.
Hopefully not in August or September.
Yeah. In August, September, you'll be making some of those decisions with me not here. I'd like to get a better... I'm not a lawyer. I don't know how the courts work that well. And I would like to get a little better idea of what's the most efficient way of getting this done. And that means, I think, looking very quickly at some of the states and see whether the models are out there and making sure that the proposal you've made is the most efficient one for getting the job done. And that's all I'd ask at this point. I know it's spending a lot of time, but I think we need to move there, but...
Chair Richardson, as in debates, we can
be a big chunk of your budget.
We can contact American Bar Association, and they probably can pull that together. I've actually seen the article you're talking about. It's a fairly current article. We could find out from the Bar Association if there are models around the country that people are using or a model that might fit for us, where they've used some combination. I think the package we have here is a pretty good combination. I'm not an attorney either, but being able to rely on some of the paralegals' time to do some of the tasks that I understand from your comments yesterday as an attorney, a lot of the things that are done that an attorney officially will write off on or will present in court are actually the work behind the scenes that's being done by the paralegals. We'd be glad to come back with that, and we also have some answers from the questions yesterday that we could give you in writing in the interim while we research that issue with ABA.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Westland and then Representative Hanna.
I would also suggest you contact NCSL, National Conference of State Legislatures, for a best practices summary of what other states are doing.
Good idea. Mm-hmm.
Chair Richardson, Senator Westland.
Easy.
That'd be great.
In a short period of time.
Great.
Thank you. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would also note that this very issue in the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety is being discussed, and we are having this same conversation. And I would, from my perspective and hearing it from both public safety and the human services side, the only comment that I think, you know, in my mind, this proposal is the first shot at how to handle it. And because we had the district attorneys in from the public safety side to talk about this, I spoke with several of them independent of the testimony or the hearing. And specific to, again, rural areas, Lake Klamath, Harney, far central and eastern Oregon, it seems to me that there is a hybrid method here that might better serve where the district attorneys did take part of this role, because even if you put DOJ folks in five offices up and down the I-5 corridor and some in Pendleton, it leaves a vast uncovered area of our state, and there might be a model that would better reflect rural Oregon, where the district attorneys who are already there, and in many cases, and this is coming from them, they're standing in the courtroom when this is happening. They literally are giving, in essence, free information now to the caseworker because they're standing next to them. And the caseworker isn't certified to do legal work and is asking. I mean, they're having a conversation in the courtroom. They're getting this kind of help. There's an opportunity, I believe, to have a mix of help here, and I really believe we need to further explore that option.
I would assume that there would be funding for them to assist, because if I were DA and I was listening to this, I'd say, the last thing I need is more work, but with funding, I mean, they're in place.
They are in place, so and that would be, this was not meant to be unfunded.
Yeah, certainly. Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Oh, Senator.
I have a question for Representative Hanna. In those discussions, has there been any discussion about whether or not this is something that really needed to get done? Is there a real risk here? Is there a discussion like we are setting ourselves up to have this thing settled by the courts if we don't do something?
Urgency.
There's been a great deal of discussion and testimony both to the fact that we are at risk with cases that we're representing. We are representing legally that we don't have the authority to do that. And I think both the district attorneys and the DOJ recognize that sometimes we're on a tightrope when we're handling it the way we are. Not all cases, but for some cases, we're walking a tightrope.
I guess that has two aspects. One is competency, which is one, and the other is legality. Well, I mean, as far as practicing law without a license, we're a legislature, and we can exempt them just as there's other exemptions if that were the issue. But the more important one is the competency to assure that justice is being done, that things are being handled well. We have very experienced DHS workers who could quit their job and become paralegals for law firms that do this kind of work because of their knowledge of the way it works. And so, I mean, I work with paralegals all the time. A certificate means nothing. It's what your real life experience is that makes the difference. But it's also about all the various jobs that they have to do, and this is a lot of responsibility for them to have, and there have been changes in the law. Am I correct that in these kinds of cases that we're talking about, these serious cases, that the child normally has an attorney? Do parents have an attorney?
Yes, Chair Richardson, they do. Okay. In most of these cases, that's true.
Yeah. So the concern about the department getting sued is an unreal concern, because you have the parties, you have the department, and you have a judge. And the judge isn't going to just allow something to go through that's nuts. So you've got attorneys already there. You have a DHS worker who understands what's going on but may need, you know, legal assistance. And then you have a judge. And so I'm not as worried about there being a flagrant abuse of justice in a courtroom situation like that or a hearing situation like that. But the fact that the workers have so much to do, and that this is a very technical thing, and that there are time limits, those are very real issues, and they're not really trained in the technical aspects of it, although that is another aspect, and that is you hire more caseworkers, and you train them, say, okay, you're doing this anyway, you're now going to be trained in what the timelines are and that kind of thing. I mean, there's no reason to think that they're not mentally competent or able to learn that. That would be another model to follow to assist the DAs, but I'm just saying we need to look at multiple aspects and not merely jump into a situation where we see is going to be a huge ongoing increasing expense merely because that's the one that's recommended.
And Chair Richardson, there's one thing that you said that I did want to, we can get you some figures on, but a lot of our workers are new. I was amazed the other day. I saw a figure, and I don't want to quote it without going back and looking at it again, but how many of our staff maybe have less than 2 years' experience or 1 year? And so the scenario in which you might have someone such as myself who's done child welfare for a long time going into court, kind of knowing what are the things that are the red flags, what are the things I listen for, is very different when you're talking about frontline staff who go in there and they don't have 5-10 years experience. One of the examples that we gathered up yesterday was a worker who was about to be held in contempt of court after about 8 months because the worker had been ordered originally to provide a certain report to the court and to all parties, and this worker was to do that periodically. What he was providing was not adequate, and no one thought it was adequate, and so the worker, by the time they called DOJ and said, we've got a problem, we're about to be held in contempt of court, DOJ went in and started looking, and it had never met the standard of evidence that the court was looking for. So I carry with me this image of what many of our young staff, they are struggling with what they have on their plates. When I heard the young woman say yesterday they're only spending 12% of their time, you know, actually with children and families. So as they go to court, many of them will not have the kinds of experiences or the longevity with the agency to be able to handle some of the things that are thrown at them by attorneys representing parents and representing children and so forth. But I will get you those figures about the youth of our, not necessarily the youth, but how long our workers have actually been in the field doing this work.
It may be that the paralegals are needed because they're spread out over the state and could be almost, or at least available in to assist the caseworkers. I don't know. It's not done yet. We would like to see the additional information.
We'll be glad to provide that.
Not to support the proposal, but to ventilate options.
Chair Richardson, we'd be very glad to provide that.
Thank you. Other items? Issues that you want us to address before we move on? Okay. We welcome our visitors here. Thanks for coming today. Are there other key issues that you'd like to have us make sure that we deal with in the time that's remaining, Ramona?
I would call Mr. Neely back up to the table just in case he has some key issues or any issues that you all wanted to. We didn't touch too much this time on the Child Protective Services part, but I would share with you that some of the work that's happening right now in child protection on May the 12th, we're going to be presenting Wayne Holder, who has been doing some of the expert evaluation of our system in Child Protective Services, especially around child safety, and that's going to be the morning of the 12th. I think Representative Dalto's committee will be hosting that. And so while it's not directly related to this presentation, I think it's going to be a lot of very useful information to us in looking to see how Oregon compares to other states around the issues of child safety and what some of the things are that we need to be doing to address some of the concerns from the national perspective.
Neely?
Mr. Chair, and for the record, Jim Neely with Children, Adults, and Families. Given the number of pages that have general information that we haven't gone over, I'm not sure that it would make sense to focus on any particular areas, especially since you have the new information in front of you. It may be that as you go through that information and have specific questions, we could either put something in writing to you or handle it as you'd like.
Mr. Chair, I intend to sit down quietly and read through this, and probably with the whole fault. I mean, I've not seen this before. Did you? You may have seen it before, but I haven't.
I got it last night.
So I just got it this morning. So if it was there last night, I didn't see it. So.
No, well, it was after hours.
All right. Ramona, you know, we're willing to go ahead and conclude the meeting today unless there are items that you would like to make sure that we touch on. I mean, you've answered our questions. We have some items that you're going to be giving to us. There may be some follow-up which we can deal with directly.
And, Chair Richardson, there is one thing that came across since we had phase one, and I will provide this to Sheila because it's more of just a general interest, a study that's come out around youth aging out of foster care. And early on in phase one, there were a number of questions about what happens to those young people. And they did this study based on the state of Washington and the state of Oregon, and they looked at how children were served in foster care in both the private sector and in the public sector. And I happened to have public radio on and heard this being presented in Congress. And so it is a study that is probably 60 or 80 pages, but this is a nice little summary of what that is. And I bring that to your attention because, of course, one of the items we talked about is what happens to these young people who are in foster care and are never going to go back home, and yet they're also not candidates for adoption at this point. And so some of the news was distressing in terms of what these young people face. But there was a comment you had made the other day in terms of just how do we make sure that young people coming through the system have opportunities and have the chances that we would want for our own children. And I think this study kind of speaks to that a little bit. It's not all dreary. It was not all doom and gloom. Some of the children have actually, these young people, now they're being interviewed, they're in their 20s and 30s, and some of them have done quite well. But I do think it speaks to some of the problems we have with the foster care system becoming the permanent parent to children in care. And, of course, that's never, the state to be your parent is never a good outcome generally for children. So I'll make sure Sheila has that, and it has a website if you want to read more of the information from that study.
Okay, thank you. Also, your comment about 60% of the children that reach the age of majority go back to their families brings up an issue. I've had a circumstance where girls turn 18, and they're now out of the system. And they say, well, what do I do now? I mean, you know, because they're not exactly the star performers that are just going to go on to college on a scholarship, and so...
Right.
It's like they have no place to go. They don't know what to do, and they're. I don't know if the system has been changed in recent years, but that's
We're trying to change the system, Chair Richardson, but that is the whole, the Chafee Independence Act and the whole issue around independent living is simply trying to make sure that children who didn't have the opportunity to grow up with their own families but have grown up in the foster care system and often as have multiple placements, that they have at least a chance when they turn 18 of being able to compete with other children in terms of getting into some kind of education program, some kind of a school system. You hear a lot in this state, especially from the Portland area, about the number of homeless children and how children who have had an experience in foster care generally are overrepresented in the homeless population. And so it certainly is an area we've got to do a lot better in the system because the reality is, as you all have been talking about this morning, not every child is going to be adopted and not every child is going to get to go back home or should go back home. And so what can we do to kind of leverage some opportunities for those children so when they turn 18 and they look at you and they say, well, what do I do now? I once had an experience of having to go down to a bus station. This was when I was living in South Carolina and picking up a young person, and he was 17, and he didn't know how to use a payphone. And the police had called our agency. We were in the central office. They didn't know who else to call, and I was just amazed. He was being transported from one location to the other, and the worker had sent him off with the bus ticket, but he got stranded. The bus broke down. He got stranded and didn't even know how to use the phone to make a reverse phone call to his foster family where he was going. I mean, it's those kinds of very basic kinds of skills. We've got to make sure that every child in foster care has those skills. And that's just a minor one. That's nothing like being able to interview for a job or fill out an application to go to school or anything else. So we could give you some more detail also about some of the things that are happening here in Oregon for the population of kids that you're talking about.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Bay.
This tweaks my curiosity. That's a sounds like a pretty good study on foster care children. Do we have any information on what happens to adopted children who have been adopted later in life? I mean, 6, 7, 8 years old. Do they return to their biological families too?
Chair Richardson and Senator Bates, I think that is not what has happened. I again would rely on Kathy. I won't call her back up during the lateness of the hour, but she can send you something in writing. But I think generally what they're finding is because we have more open adoption. By the way, the state is a pioneer in the concept of open adoption. But because children who are older and are adopted generally know where they came from, there's not that mystery of them going out and then trying to find out later who were my parents, what was my community. Many of our older children grow up knowing that, and so that's part of the counseling children get as they go through the adoption process. We also have registers, of course, so that families can locate, an individual can locate who might my birth parents have been if they want that information when they get older, and if the birth parent has also registered. So Oregon does provide that service as well.
I think you missed the question I'll talk about later. I want to know what those kids do when they get out of their, when they reach 18, 19, or 20, do they stay connected emotionally with their adoptive parents, or do they go back to their biological parents? How well do they do in school?
Okay, Chair Richardson, Senator Bates, I think that we will find that they are, what we know is, from adoptions that have happened prior to ASFA, those children do stay connected with the adoptive families. The outcomes are good for those families. What we don't have probably is the research yet on the large number of children in this country being adopted under ASFA. We don't have reason to think that those outcomes would be different, although we've already said the children themselves are more difficult kids when they're being placed adoptively now. So there is a lot of interest nationally in researching that piece to see what is the long-term outcomes for those kids, but at this point we're still hopeful that it's working.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Without further delay, we will go ahead and adjourn for the day.
Thank you.
Thank you.